Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
Hello, this is The Takeaway for Wednesday, December 21st, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
People have waited out in the freezing cold. Indeed, overnight we received reports of death by overexposure as they wait for their besiegers to deign to give them license to depart.
That's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, speaking this week, outraged but commenting powerlessly on the final evacuation of civilians and opposition forces from Aleppo, Syria. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is back in control. The siege of Aleppo is over. And these most vulnerable evacuees become the latest flood of Syrian refugees into Turkey, bound for unknown new homes. The Russian-supported assault on Aleppo was ruthless, and the end result came at a huge cost. An indiscriminate and relentless bombing campaign that targeted civilians and medical facilities allegedly involved the use of cluster munitions and possibly chemical weapons. A meeting on Tuesday between Iranian, Russian, and Turkish defense ministers produced a joint declaration to find a solution in Syria, signifying something of a V for Victory Day for Aleppo and possibly the entire Syria crisis. And not even the assassination of Russia's ambassador to Turkey this week got in the way of those talks. Ambassador Ryan Crocker joins us now. He's a veteran of the Foreign Service, served 37 years there, former ambassador to Syria, Iraq, Pakistan, Kuwait, Afghanistan, and Lebanon. Ambassador Crocker, is this a V-Day for Syria, or are we seeing the partition of a country that was once among the most stable in the Middle East?
Thanks, John, for having me. We are seeing all of those things. It is a huge victory for Russia. They had a very poor hand going in. They played it brilliantly. We didn't even show up at the table. So that's why you see meetings on some kind of resolution here don't even include us.
And is that to say that we have just as limited a role in the ousting of ISIS as we do in the business of who's running Syria right now?
I think that's right, again, on both counts. This administration has checked out. It doesn't matter how many civilians get killed. It doesn't matter how many drown crossing the Mediterranean. This administration, and that definitely includes Samantha Power, don't care.
And what is the reason for this? Is it fatigue from the other wars? Is it Barack Obama just deciding to get out of town as soon as possible? It appears that at some point, the U.S. just sort of faded out of any rational role in the Middle East on any level.
Well, that's exactly right, John. President Obama has checked out, and the rest of his staff, including Samantha Power, has checked out with him. We tell the Russians how evil and awful they are in Syria, yet every time another civilian strike takes place, John Kerry calls Minister Lavrov. So we go beyond, frankly, appeasement. We're complicit in what is happening in Aleppo.
When you say complicit in the sense that we didn't fight back, or we're complicit in that we support the Russian victory of Bashar al-Assad?
I think it's more of the second, that we are totally fine with whatever the Russians decide to do, however many civilians they decide to kill. It's okay with us, because that's the signal all of these repetitive discussions with the Russians illustrates. So for Samantha Power to sit out there and say we are shocked, simply shocked, no, she's a little bit brighter than that. This is what we bought into.
Listen here to something that Vladimir Putin was saying back in April of this year. He was telling people, and it's through translation here, but he was telling people that it is in the interest of the Americans to to understate the success of the Russians in Syria, and he was almost laughing as he spoke.
So however Western media would like to silence or downplay our success, this is frankly impossible. For some people, it is their job to underrate and underinform their audiences, readers, listeners.
They will complain it's futile, he says, but the end result is just the same. Putin saw this coming months ago.
Yes, he did, and he helped arrange it months ago. And that is why I say that it's not like we didn't have forewarning. The Russians are not in Syria to make life better for Syrians. They are in Syria to support their guy, Bashar al-Assad, and they've done it brilliantly. And they have drug us right into it so that whether you're talking about strategic moves or humanitarian moves, we are part of the Russian playbook.
Now, thinking about the Trump administration incoming, who appears to have a degree of sympathy with Vladimir Putin, if not stylistically, then in policy terms, do you think the Trump administration is inclined to accept this victory of Bashar al-Assad and pursue a fundamentally different course in the Middle East?
Obviously, to be determined. Some of the president-elect's appointments sit very well with me, to make former Marine General Jim Mattis his Secretary of Defense. Well, they don't call Jim Mattis Mad Dog for nothing. He's a fighter. John Kelly, who's been tapped for Homeland Security, he's another fighter. So we'll see what they do. But there are some of these appointments that actually encourage me a bit.
Encourage you in terms of fighting Bashar al-Assad or fighting in the Middle East on the side of Russia?
John, here's the deal. We established the post-World War II international environment. The United Nations was created in San Francisco. The Bretton Woods Agreement were created in New Hampshire to establish the international financial order. That's the era we are in, but I am increasingly concerned that is also the era that President Obama is checking out of, and that Donald Trump will follow suit. They may be different on a lot of issues, but in terms of the United States playing a role in the region, they both checked out.
Well, that's really interesting. I don't know if you've been following the lobbying resume of Michael Flynn, who's Trump's designated national security advisor. He's written that the Erdogan government should be supported full force, that in fact, up to the extradition of Mr. Ghulam in Pennsylvania, that he would support an all-out, absolute capitulation with Erdogan's policies, both domestically and as regards Mr. Ghulam in Pennsylvania. What do you think the impact of that would be, and do you think it's likely to happen?
I don't think it's likely to happen. I do agree with General Flynn on the point that we need to be engaged with Turkey. They are a founding member of NATO, and what happens there affects everything. I have to say, though, that General Flynn as national security advisor compared to iconic folks like Brent Scowcroft, this isn't going to work very well.
Is that to say that a coherent policy on human rights and the, I guess, encouragement of progressive liberalism in the world is now really in the freezer, and that essentially there will be some other fundamental realpolitik pursuit of policy during the Trump administration? That's really all that's possible here, is finding the strong players and getting with them. And if you look at Trump's words, standing up to China.
John, you have absolutely nailed it. This is about the role the U.S. will play going forward. For 70 years, since the end of World War II, the U.S. has been front and center in the international order. Obviously, you can take issue with some of the stances we have taken, but we were always there. And here's the point of commonality. Obama does not want us to be there anymore. Let the rest of the world take care of its own affairs. And that is kind of a scary echoing the same things we hear from President-elect Trump. So, you know, we've got to decide as a country, do we want to support the international order that we created in 1945, or do we just say, we're done here, y'all work out whatever you want. The second option is frankly, a terrifying one. We have seen what happens when the U.S. checks out. The worst refugee crisis since World War II, and we're not there. You know, we're not there for any of this. So if, as a nation, as a people, we want to back out of it, fine. Then show me what the alternatives are, because all I see now is more slaughter, more bloodshed, more chaos.
And personally, Ambassador Crocker, before we go, I mean, your 37 years of essentially keeping the United States engaged in this post-World War II order, if it crumbles right now, it makes your entire career look like a bunch of footnotes. How does that feel?
Well, one thing you learn pretty quickly in the business I'm in, the Foreign Service, is that we don't set policy. We let our elected leaders set policy. So while it hurts me deeply to see what is happening in an area I love, that's just part of the show. We implement policy. We don't make it.
Ambassador Ryan Crocker served 37 years in the Foreign Service, former ambassador to Pakistan, Kuwait, Afghanistan, and Lebanon, currently executive professor at Texas A&M University. Thank you so much, Ambassador.
Thank you, Don.
You could think of it as a hellish trip back to the 1980s. A scourge of easily available dangerous drugs has made the county roads of West Virginia look like the urban war zones of East L.A. and Miami during the crack epidemic. Those drug sales enriched the cartels of Mexico and Colombia with billions years ago. But in West Virginia today, fatal overdoses from prescription drugs has been on the rise. In a six-year period from 07 till 2012, 1,728 West Virginians died from the opioid-prescribed drugs hydrocodone and oxycodone. In that very same time period, these overdoses have spiked. Prescription drug companies like McKesson Corporation and Cardinal Health have been enriched from a flood of sales in the billions. 780 million hydrocodone and oxycodone pills were shipped across the state in that six-year period alone. Eric Ayer is a reporter for the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Your investigation has been an extraordinary look at something that seems to be tearing your state apart. Eric, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
First of all, I mean, these numbers are just staggering, and describe how they're being funneled through a relatively small number of pharmacies and counties.
Right. Most of the pharmacies we found that were receiving the massive quantities of hydrocodone, which is Lortab, and oxycodone, which is Oxycontin, they were these small, independent, locally owned pharmacies. They weren't the Rite Aids, they weren't the Walgreens, they weren't the Walmarts. There are these small, independently owned pharmacies. We found one in southern West Virginia that over 2 years had nearly 9 million hydrocodone pills shipped there. That was in a town of only 437 people. We had another county, Wyoming County, which is sort of the center of the OxyContin epidemic, and there was a pharmacy there in the county seat that was getting upwards of 600,000, 700,000 oxycodone pills a year. And there was a Rite Aid just eight blocks away that was getting 6,000 pills a year. So wide disparities.
What did these pharmacies say? Did you confront them on what the heck is going on here? I mean, in one case, 433 pills per person per member of the county.
Right. Well, The focus of the story was on the drug wholesalers. We've written a lot about the pharmacies. The contention of the pharmacies is that they fill valid prescriptions from doctors. Now, unfortunately, that's not really true. A lot of these prescriptions are illegal prescriptions from what we have here. They call them pain clinics. And what you do is if you have $200, you walk in and pay your money, and sometimes you're not even seen by a doctor and they'll write you a prescription. So that was sort of the argument of the pharmacies.
And the argument of the corporations is that everything down the chain is legal, so therefore it's none of our concern legally.
Exactly. What they say is that they're the middleman. What the drug wholesalers do is they ship the drugs from the manufacturer to the pharmacies. So they say, you know, we have, you know, a certain number of orders that and we need to fill those orders. But what was happening is they weren't reporting what's called suspicious orders, and that would be, you know, orders of unusual large size or frequency. Things, just to give an example, there'd be a pharmacy that would order, you know, 11,000 hydrocodone pills one day. A couple days later, they'd order 12,000. Another 3 days later, maybe another 15,000 hydrocodone. So there should have been some red flags.
And why weren't there? Who can go after them? Is this a state concern? The governor, of course, has made this a personal crusade.
Yes. Who can go after them? Two entities here. The DEA, of course, they have the same data that we have of these sales. And the drug wholesalers are required to report suspicious orders from pharmacies. And again, those are orders of large volume frequency. So there's both state and federal law. And we didn't actually focus on what the DEA was doing. The Washington Post has done a tremendous series of stories, Lenny Bernstein, on essentially the DEA turning a blind eye to what was going on with the distributors. But here in West Virginia, we have a West Virginia Pharmacy Board that regulates pharmacies, and we learned that there were some rules on the books, but they just weren't enforcing them.
Well, one of the statistics that's the most heartbreaking here is that the CDC now says opioid deaths have surpassed gun deaths in America. Would you suspect, since these statistics are from some years ago, 4 years ago, that as this evolves, people are going to go off prescription drugs and go straight onto street heroin?
That's exactly what has happened. The prescription drugs have sort of set the table for the heroin epidemic. Last year, for the first time, heroin overdoses actually surpassed both OxyContin and hydrocodone overdoses. And then the other thing we're really seeing, I just looked at the overdose data yesterday for this current year, so it's probably only through maybe September. But what was striking was fentanyl was climbing close to heroin. So
that's the drug that killed Prince.
Yes, right. Correct. And we've had situations here with heroin fentanyl being combined. We had a terrible tragedy where 20 people overdosed in one city in about a 6-hour period in Huntington, West Virginia. That was only a couple months ago.
At a time when people are saying that newspapers don't matter, what do you feel about your responsibility to the community here and what the impact could be?
The impact, we're kind of waiting and seeing. Our legislature meets in February, so they've talked about putting some things on the table, but it's a wait and see at this point.
Well, great work. You and your reporters have done an amazing thing there. And, you know, we're praying for you there in West Virginia. It sounds like a terrible situation with many years to go. Eric Ayer is a reporter for the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. After months of legal pressure nationally and from inside the state, North Carolina lawmakers are holding a special session today that may end with the repeal of House Bill 2, known as that bathroom bill, because of its requirement for transgender people to use restrooms matching the sex on their birth certificate. Lawsuits, loss of tourism, as well as jobs from companies such as PayPal, which canceled plans to open a payment center in Charlotte, were all consequences of this bill. HB2 is also tangled up with a number of other efforts to remove protections against discrimination and to prevent the raising of the minimum wage. The city of Charlotte has been leading the effort to restore North Carolina to a more mainstream position on these issues. Charlotte's ordinance that prevented discrimination against gay and transgender people within the city started a battle with the legislature, and HB2 was the backlash. But on Monday, the Charlotte City Council repealed their ordinance in exchange for this special session. Erica Lakowitz is a trans advocate for equality based in Charlotte who fought hard for this non-discrimination ordinance and for the repeal of HB2.
It's very difficult for us that do not what we call pass to be able to move freely without harassment. A lot of their argument, well, why aren't these things reported to the police and whatnot? When you look at how much it takes for a transgender person to be out and to be public, there's not only a lot of anxiety that goes along with it, but there's also a fear of being outed. So whereas somebody who is trying to express themselves, trying to get comfortable within their own skin, now has to worry about, oh my God, if I file a police report or if I've been assaulted, I'll just take it. I'll go home as long as my wife doesn't find out or my job doesn't find out because I could be fired. And when you set these tones that you have a non-discrimination ordinance, it segues into discussions that you can have for legitimacy, even to a spouse. Hey, our city recognizes this. And then if you did come out, you can turn around and say, look, it's not as if we're alone out there. Whereas we have been for so many years, part of the community, always around you guys, but never with the recognition that we receive from our mayor, Mayor Roberts, and the city council, and also Loretta Lynch. Because remember, when Pat removed in 24 hours our basic legitimacy as a citizen of this city, it was reinstated by Loretta Lynch with such firmness when she said, we see you. Transgender men are men and transgender women are women. So the non-discrimination ordinance is whether nullified the moment HB2 was passed, an iconic for the transgender community, an iconic step forward in what would otherwise be considered a non-progressive state as of HB2's passage, to saying, no, Charlotte is a welcoming city. And that's why you've seen so much of the protest.
So, Erica, then let's just give the GOP some credit here. They are recognizing that inclusion is really the only way to go here, even if they morally don't stand behind it.
You know, I think there's a lot of political moves in maybe that position. I think having reached out over the course of this past year to so many of them to have discussions, to feel discarded by their inabilities to want to meet, to, you know, understand us a little bit better. I mean, we've taken the initiatives on ourselves. We've created groups where we can come together with citizens from anybody. I mean, so recently, talking about HB2 with, you know, 2/3 of the majority from a Baptist church. And everybody was receptive to that. So when I hear you say, you know, this may be them making that kind of concession by trying to move the dial, I think we've tried really hard for those who have been on the ground to move that dial. I think the business community has put a tremendous amount of pressure on them to act. And I think if they don't act, I think would be a huge mistake for re-election in 2017 and moving forward. I think it's going to be a political issue if they don't fully repeal it in its entirety today.
Erica Lakowitz is a trans advocate based in Charlotte, North Carolina.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Got it, man. I'm ready.
Our response here at The Takeaway to the events of the past year is to explain, to seek truth, to call out where we see abuse and exploitation, to strike down where we see hubris and falsehoods. And we think that our best response to the political events of this year is vigilance. This is something New York Daily News columnist Sean King practices daily with his social media presence and active Facebook commentary. And we've come to admire his relentless pursuit of justice around the corner and around the world. Listen now to The Vigilance of Sean King in his own voice and words, 2016.
January 11th. I'm sorry to put this on you, but my calling is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. Babies in Madaya, Syria are starving to death. 5 confirmed casualties today. Despicable. January 20th. The funeral program of 16-year-old Janiyah McMillan died in police custody on January 11th in my home state of Kentucky. Still no real answers. March 23rd. I need you to see this. This is outrageous. This was a polling line yesterday in Maricopa County, Arizona.
This is designed to suppress the vote.
People waited for hours and hours and hours to vote. Some, as you can imagine, just had to leave to go to work or pick up their kids, etc. The state drastically cut the number of polling locations down from well over 200 to just 60. April 24th. Man kicked out of Donald Trump rally for no reason other than being black. Police don't even deny it. May 19th.
Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault.
Sharing this short, powerful clip of Malcolm X on his birthday, it's painful how true what he says here remains true to this very day. Happens almost every day in this country.
And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves.
June 3rd, bigots say bigoted things. Case in point, Donald Trump points out a black man in the audience at his rally, and in a possessive tone like he was talking about a damn slave says,
"Look at my African-American over here. Look at him."
Yeah, that was the end of the sentence. Not my African-American friend or my African-American homie, but my African-American. Yeah, that man is the Republican nominee, and it's actually 2016. June 24th.
Are you going to vote for Hillary Clinton in November?
Yes.
You knew this day was coming. I know it stings and it's a bitter pill to swallow. It is for me. If you think it's hard for you, please understand how much harder it is for Bernie to be in this position. Our values, our priorities, our principles, our positions, they are all too important to simply drop and move on. July 30th.
She came at me with those scissors.
Police shoot and kill this petite Navajo woman. Her name is L'Oreal Tensing. She was a shoplifting suspect. Notice that he manhandled her repeatedly before this. This is despicable. In any other developed country, this woman would still be alive. September 19th, the brutal Tulsa police murder of Terrence Crutcher. He was peaceful. His hands were up. Then he is murdered in cold blood and left to die alone. September 25th, I'm furious. This man, Robert Pittenger, is a United States congressman. He literally said protesters of police brutality, quote,
"They hate white people because white people are successful and they're not."
This is not just offensive, it's dangerous. This man is a lawmaker. November 27th. I don't think I will ever fully adjust to Donald Trump as president of the United States. It's just so utterly damn ridiculous. November 30th. President Obama has actually done a pretty good job as president at hiring a truly diverse staff. From cabinet positions all the way down to interns, he has attempted to build a team that looks like America. Unfortunately, he has less than 2 months left in office, and most of that diversity will be flushed down the toilet. December 4th. I must say this. Indigenous people stopped the Dakota Access Pipeline. Don't get it twisted. Liberal activists supported the efforts, no doubt, but the heart and soul of what happened in Standing Rock was driven by local people who put their lives on the line. All protest of injustice must be driven by local people, and local people must get the credit and love for the victories.
As you can hear from his voice in the previous segment, Sean King is not afraid to disrupt the smooth pond of the status quo in the pursuit of what he calls social justice. His bold statements and initiatives have given him a large audience and lots of reaction. He's the senior justice writer for the New York Daily News and remains an activist in the Black Lives Matter movement. Earlier this month, on the 61st anniversary of the launch of the Montgomery bus boycott, he launched the Injustice Boycott, an organized resistance, he says, against racial injustice and police brutality in the United States. Is it working? Well, it's all part of the high decibel accountability that King brings to his work. This year, he's been tracking the number of hate crimes, people killed by police, and those who are currently incarcerated, and he compares those stats to create an index for comparing conditions today with conditions years ago. And King says the number of people in jail today overwhelms the data from even much more violent periods in America's past.
If we look at previous generations, we had about 200,000 people who were incarcerated in this country. Now we have 2.5 million. Last year, there were 1,208 people killed by police in this country. That's the highest number ever recorded. And we believe that that is the highest number of people ever killed by police in any given year. And so in some ways, this country has improved. But in other ways, we have fallen back and gotten worse.
Let's take apart the incarceration figure first. There does appear to be a consensus to reform sentencing and to change and address the consequences of the law and order approach to crime in the 1980s. Do you think that's going to go anywhere?
I don't. I think we were building something that felt like a consensus. But Donald Trump, in every public way, has said, hey, I am the law and order president. And he was kind of roundly endorsed by the Fraternal Order of Police, the national organization, many of the local organizations. And they are very publicly against those very basic reforms, sentencing reforms, and the basic justice reforms that we thought had bipartisan support. A lot of the people who support Donald Trump don't support them. And so I feel like we're at a point where we had a lot of potential, but I get the hunch that we've squandered that potential.
Even the fiscal realities aren't going to drive this. Republicans, particularly in Texas and Oklahoma and other places in the traditionally Republican South, have said this doesn't work, this building prisons, this prison industry. We have to fundamentally do something different. And even if you don't look at the incarceration figures, but just look at the people who are dropped back into society with like just bus fare, they're seeing the consequences of this. There's kind of no way to avoid this.
Yeah, well, I hope you're right. And, you know, most change, particularly over these next 4 years, is going to be local change. And most people who are incarcerated in local jails or state prisons. And so we need to go local. And that's what I'm doing. I'm focusing on city governments where we often have so-called progressive mayors in office, state governments, state houses. And I think there's a lot of progress that could be made in California, in New York, in cities like Portland and Seattle, Atlanta and Charlotte. And we haven't focused very much on holding progressive and democratic local governments accountable. And I think now we're going to be going local way more than we ever have.
Let's talk about the police for a moment. A lot of people who criticize you say that you come down on the police inappropriately. And Ta-Nehisi Coates, for instance, suggests that the police are the carriers of a permission that once existed to attack black bodies.
Yeah.
And that unless you explicitly turn that off, turn that permission off, it's on. It's sort of not their fault, but they're a reflection of something. I mean, it may be their fault. It may not be their fault. But in other words, there's no way that's not going to happen unless you explicitly turn it off. Do you buy that idea?
Yeah. I agree with that completely. And it's a beautiful analysis by Ta-Nehisi in that unless people are held accountable, And here's the thing. I fully agree, and I've said this publicly. It just doesn't trend or get shared. I do believe that most police are good people and most police do a great job. But when we're talking about 10 to 15% of police who may bend the rules, who may be more brutal than the 80 to 90% of their counterparts, we're still talking about tens of thousands of incidents of brutality all across the country every year. And it's brutality that doesn't exist in the same form in any developed country in the world. And we have to ask ourselves, why are our police so brutal in ways that they aren't in other places? And Ta-Nehisi is right. Police feel like they have permission for very good reason. And it's because even in the most egregious cases, be it the shooting death of Amadou Diallo or in so many other instances, police still get off. And so,
and history stalks. History is the ghost.
Yeah, it is.
America's violent history is in the background.
Absolutely, man. You know, so I compare, when I speak across the country, I compare the problem of modern day police brutality to the epidemic of lynching in previous generations, and that the brutality of police, for all intents and purposes, replaced the lynching of a previous generation. So if we look at it, we would have to go back. Last year in 2015, 102 completely unarmed black men, women, and children were killed by police. We would have to go all the way back to 1902 to find a single year in American history where that many black folk were lynched in this country. And that's just the men and women who had no knives, no guns, no weapons, many of them no criminal records, in instances where brutality was avoidable, but police served as judge, jury, and executioner, much in the same way that we saw lynching, particularly in the 1890s and early 1900s.
Is the reason for that, and you've sort of partially answered this, is the reason for that the police are out of control, or that we haven't addressed as a society that period of time in our history, that Jim Crow lynching period? We talk a lot about slavery. We talk a lot about the Underground Railroad and those sorts of things, but we really don't deal with that early 20th century terrorism moment, and that's the ghost that lives today.
It is the ghost of America in so many ways, and no, we haven't addressed it in any substantive way. And in a lot of ways, the way we do race in America is we say, we got over that, let's move on. And I think we have greatly exaggerated and overestimated what we've gotten over in this country. But police brutality is actually an incredibly complicated problem. I wrote a 25-part series on how we address and solve issues of police brutality. And what I never said publicly, because I thought people would almost laugh at it, is behind the scenes, I wrote out almost 100 reasons, you know, that really feed this monster of police brutality. And I had to kind of pare it down to 25 different ways, 25 different issues that kind of feed this monster. And so it's an incredibly complicated problem. And social media, I will admit, doesn't do a great job at dissecting the complicated nature of this problem or any problem. And so when we reduce a problem to a tweet or a Facebook post, we've often grossly oversimplified it. And that's the case with police brutality.
Do you think that there is an argument over who gets to be mad about racial injustice in America?
Well, I don't think there's a legitimate argument over who gets to be mad, but it's so complicated that it's very easy to unknowingly step on people's toes or say something insensitive unintentionally or wade into an issue that you may have never experienced, but then still talk about it with a degree of authority that ends up really irritating people who have experienced it. And so when I speak at colleges all around the country, and one of the first questions I get every single time is, "Hi, Sean, I am white and I'm deeply bothered by racial injustice. What do I do and how can I talk about it?" And my answer to that is always, first and foremost, listen more than you talk. And if you're going to fight for racial justice, be willing to survive the awkward moments, the moments where people that you feel like you're fighting for may be disappointed in something you've said and done. Be willing to wade through the difficult and challenging discussions that are sure to happen. And that will help kind of buy the loyalty of the people you're fighting for. But what a lot of black folk have found is that sometimes when these conversations get messy, a lot of people they thought were their allies check out and move on. And black folk don't have the ability, people of color or women who are fighting for their rights, don't have the ability to not be a woman, to not be black, to not be oppressed. And it's sometimes discouraging on a level that people who don't experience that oppression struggle to understand, to see people you thought were fighting for you walk away and move on. And it can hurt.
So the important thing for people who claim or have experienced more white privilege than black oppression, to be vigilant. The idea is that if we're all equally vigilant, or if we're all significantly vigilant, we can put this away.
Yeah.
But if only one group is paying attention, we'll never make progress.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And to double down on that sentiment, there is this notion about race and racism in America that, even though it is rather widely accepted that black folk are the primary recipients of racism, By and large, black folk are also the primary people expected to fix the problem. And that's just not how it works. And so what a lot of us are looking for are for people who aren't a part of that oppressed group, whatever situation that is, to fight for that problem with the people you have influence over. And often we see something peculiar where we see white men or women fighting against racism, but doing it sometimes with a primarily black audience. And what we're hoping is that influential white men and women will speak more about issues of race and racism and discrimination, oppression, to primarily white audiences and to influence the people who may be more likely to be racist.
Sean King, senior justice writer for the New York Daily News. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, man.
If you happen to see the very entertaining movie this season from Marvel Studios, Doctor Strange, then you know the entire universe is held together through special supernatural powers and an ancient archive of history in the headquarters of the Sorcerer Supreme called simply The Library. The Librarian is a cheerless, no-nonsense fellow named Wong. The Sorceress, well, don't mess with her.
What did you just do to me?
I pushed your astral form out of your physical form.
What's in that tea? Psilocybin? LSD?
It's just tea. With a little honey.
In the headquarters of the United States of America, on the other hand, the Library of Congress is that very same archive of history and the power of history. And while she has no superpowers, I like to think of Carla Hayden, the new Librarian of Congress, as part no-nonsense librarian and part sorceress. She is actually the first real librarian to hold the post, the first woman, and the first African-American. She says that there's nothing strange about this moment in American history, regardless of the politics. Carla Hayden says there's never been a time when holding on tight to history and telling the story of America has been more important.
It's exciting in terms of the possibilities of using and harnessing technology at a time when technology has had such an impact on libraries in particular, when you think about the information age and communication and scholarship, reading, publishing, all of those things come together around the library environment. And so the Library of Congress can really be, I think, a leader in helping think about how all kinds of libraries will progress. And I think we will progress and not fade away.
Are you a custodian of American literacy in any sense?
The Library of Congress, and this is what's so exciting for me, it's the custodian and also, I think, a promoter of human creativity, especially in the United States. It was developed to help Congress make its decisions and then progressed even more as a national library because of the copyright process. And that became the basis of building a national collection that is unparalleled.
How important is outreach to keep everybody understanding that there is this national mission to maintain a collection there in Washington that's accessible to people all over the country and the world?
That's one of my main priorities because there are so many people that don't realize that this is their library too. This is America's library. And so the outreach is going to be a major focus of my term, and I have a tenure, an appointment. We're going to start with traveling exhibits, for instance. An 18-wheeler might pull up in your community that will have exhibits from the Library of Congress. We are expanding our digital reach. There's a new look on the homepage of the Library of Congress that's more interactive and that really draws you into the collections, as well as using social media and then digitizing as many collections as we can so that the collections will be at your fingertips.
How important is architecture? There are many cities in the United States that have used a progressive library, Seattle Library is an example, to transform the sense of the public forum, the public space.
I knew you were going to say Seattle, where that's a place with librarian envy. We all love that. Librarian envy. And for instance, the New York Public Libraries, it's really like a castle or a palace. The innovative things that are going on in terms of making those iconic spaces more usable, friendly, softer, but also maintaining that majesty as well. And so you're in a place, you're having coffee, you're on your laptop, but you can look around and look at the Rose Reading Room. And that's like a temple to knowledge and wisdom and everything.
You interested in getting into retail at all?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the Library of Congress, for instance, has a store, and we are looking at museum stores that have been very successful. MoMA, for instance, has a wonderful new design store. And other places that have taken their materials and put them into formats that people would want to wear or buy or carry bags.
Here's a serious question. In this time of America's, I think, courageous in some cases, reexamination of its history, do you have a special place of responsibility being the curator of really that history?
Libraries all over the country are finding people wanting to read more about it, finding out about characters like Benedict Arnold. All of these iconic figures, but people who also witness history that you might not know about. And so making history come alive for people and sharing that so that they get a sense that the time that they're living in is part of a continuum and that we're on a journey. And we may think that things are so unique now and they've never happened before. And especially for younger people, it's good for them to, I think, have a sense of place, but also placement on the arc of history and think about making their own history.
That's a great job.
It's a great job. And to think that I get to open up this treasure chest and work with people who are devoted curators and librarians, the depth of knowledge that the staff members have at the Library of Congress, you can ask any question and they can give you not only the answer to your question but follow up things.
I wonder if this is a moment with the opening of the African American Museum in Washington and with the popularity of the Native American Museum in Washington, D.C., to really take another look at the history of Native people in the U.S. With the pipeline controversy that's going on right now, and to really bring that forward not as a angry revisionist idea but as a, look, we need to all be on the same page about what happened in America's early history.
And history gives you perspective. It can. And we like to say in the library world, read more about it. One question leads to another. And that intellectual curiosity, well, why is this such a issue and what brought people to this point? Hopefully will give some deeper understanding to the emotions and what you're seeing right there in front of you. But this, a lot of this emotion might come from a long history or it's part of a journey as well.
First book you ever borrowed from a public library?
Well, the one that I got my first taste of finds was PS 96. That's where I went to grammar school. And there was a Queens storefront branch. And the first book was Bright April. And I checked it out, learned about library finds. But I still love it to this day. It was about a little girl who I thought looked like me. She was African-American, a brownie, pigtails. And I still love that book. I have copies of that book.
Well, it's so great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you.
So nice to hear someone at such a high level in government who is free of all of the madness that's been going on this year in partisan terms and political terms and really is doing a job that is so meaningful right now.
Well, thank you. Hope to come back.
Dr. Carla Hayden is the 14th Librarian of Congress, having assumed that position in September of this year. And may all your library books get returned on time this 2016. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Public Radio International.